Welcome to Babbittville, where the roads are always smooth, the water's always warm, and the wind is always at your back. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you every Sunday night by 1020, www.cal1020.com, a 10-mile race on February 15th with 20 bands along the way, and coresports.com, great women's clothing. And you can check out any of our interviews on Babbittville on iTunes. Our next guest, seriously, one of the true running legends, a guy who won a bronze medal 1972 at 1,500 meters, and 11 years later won 208.59, one of the most dramatic marathons ever in New York City, to win New York City Marathon. From 800 meters to through the marathon, there really are very few runners with his pedigree. Mr. Rod Dixon joins us. Rodney, how the heck are you?
I'm great, Bob. I'm great. And it's from Babbittville to Hobbitville.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You're dealing with the little guys.
Yeah.
I love that. So Rodney, take me back. Growing up in New Zealand, was running always your sport, and did your brother get you into that?
Yeah. You know, Bob, it really was. I mean, I remember I ran away from home when I was 4 years old. And my brother's school called my mother and said, "Are you missing your son, Rodney?" And she said, "Yes, I can't find him anywhere. I'm beside myself." He said, "Well, he's 2 miles down here at your other son's school." And what I'd done is I'd run down to see my brother. So I was always on the move. There's no doubt about that. I was constantly challenged by my brother, being nearly 4 years older, that if he can do it, I can do it. I mean, whether it was climbing up a tree or swimming across a fast-moving river,
yeah. Which,
it was always a challenge. And he gave me the belief and the inspiration that I can do what he can do. And I think I just developed from that. I mean, I think too, Bob, in school, all my school reports were Rodney's easy distracted. He distracts other people. He fidgets. He's always looking out the window. And, of course, one of my teachers recognized this and would send me off to deliver a note halfway across the school. And he said that he would see me go out the door, run around the whole school grounds, drop the note off, and run all the way back. And what it was, Bob, I had to be moving. Today kids are diagnosed with ADD and medicated. But fortunately, in my day, I was sent out to go for a run and let that energy come back and recalibrate my brain. And I wasn't a bad student when I was able to move.
Well, it's funny because that's what all the parents did, right? They sent us out, go play, and we'll see you later.
Yeah.
And like 5-6 hours later, and hopefully you'll be fatigued enough to sit down and eat and be a normal person.
And yes.
Yeah. So. When did you realize that you had a talent for running? Was that in high school?
No, I think you know, my brother, of course, was the 100-meter champion or the 100 yards in those days. And then I came on and I won the elementary school 100 yards championships. And then I went on to middle school and then into high school. And I was always a good runner, but I was never the best when I got to high school. But I just loved running. I'd played rugby, field hockey, soccer. I played cricket, but all those sports didn't give me that perpetual motion and the ability to keep moving. And I always found that when I joined the running club, which was when I was 12 years old, and that was my calling. I love to run on the farmlands, on the beaches, on the golf course, be challenged by this or that. There wasn't road running in those days, or there was for the older ones, but us little guys were not allowed to run on the roads. I was too, you know, they didn't close the roads down like that today.
Right.
So it really was. I knew, and my parents knew, that I was born to run. There was that the genetics was there. The DNA was there, Bob.
So, 68, the Olympics are happening in Mexico City. We forget about that now. It's like, well, you know, you'll get somebody will tweet or someone will post online or you'll watch it on TV. But the Olympics are going on in Mexico City. It's not like you could watch a thing. The only way you could sort of find out what's going on, what, a transistor radio?
Transistor radio, exactly. The I think in those days it was called the wireless.
Yeah, that was wireless. Exactly. That was wireless. But not batteries. You had to have batteries.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, we'd seen in the newspapers, you know, pictures of New Zealanders at the games. We had seen reports, and of course the Radio New Zealand posted their schedule, and of course the 1500 meter final was scheduled, and so all of us runners in the club, because I was 17 at the time,
yeah.
We all gathered down by the Mai Tai River in Nelson with a transistor radio, and in fact, somebody brought along a bottle of beer. It was like a quart bottle. I think it might have been 2 quart bottles. And so we had a couple of sips of the beer and a bit of static, and away we were, and we gathered around the radio and listening to that incredible, because at that stage, you know, Kip Kino was the unknown African.
Yes.
Kenyan. And Jim Ryan, of course, the incredibly talented high school runner, first man to break sub 4 minute mile at high school, and this was building up to be the great challenge, the great
finals, yeah.
It was, and so as lap after lap, and of course we realize what we realize is that Ben Jipjoe, Kino's
his teammate, yeah.
He led out. And, of course, they were both from the Rift Valley, which was 7,000 feet, and Mexico City being at altitude.
Really high altitude, yeah.
Yeah. They were going to run the legs off Jim Ryan.
Yep.
And, of course, that was set up, and Kino had a huge lead with a lap to go. Ryan ran, of course, incredibly, I think 52 or 53 last lap, to come within just a few yards, but kind of across the line, and Ryan was second, so gold and silver. So that was, I mean, I leapt to my feet, and I said, oh, my gosh, this is unbelievable. And I turned to my mates, and I said, that's me. I'm going to the Olympics. I'm going to do that, you guys. And they said, have you been drinking all the beer, Dixon? And I said, I'd had my share, but I said, no. And, of course, you know, Bob, this, 4 years later, I was at the Olympic Games. And, of course, it would have been so cool to have tweeted my mates and said, I told you I'd be here.
So, wait, you're at the first round of the 1500, and you had been listening to Kano against Jim Ryan.
Yeah.
And who was in that first heat?
Oh, yeah, well, that's right. The first round, two runners would advance to the semifinal, and then the two fastest qualifiers from the heats would go through to the next round.
Right.
And I'm standing on the, well, because we did get the start list that afternoon, so I knew who I was going to be up against. But incredibly, as I stood on the start line, Kino was on my left and Ryan was on my right. Now, how about that?
I love that. Talk about a dream come true, right?
Well, it was, I mean, today you'd do a little selfie, wouldn't you?
Exactly. Hey, guys, let me take a selfie real quick. You look at that era of John Walker and Dick Quacks and yourself in terms of what was the great runners from New Zealand. What was it that era or that time of, in that time where the New Zealanders were exceptional?
Well, it was. I think what it was, Bob, is with the I was very, very aware of the history of New Zealand. And when we go back to 1936 and Jack Lovelock won the gold medal in Berlin, defeating the world record holder Glenn Cunningham from the United States, you know, that really set something. And I remember reading the books like The Kings of Distance, and I was always fascinated by running back in the 20s and the 30s. And then, of course, along came Peter Snell.
Peter Snell, yeah.
Harry Hilberg, who within an hour won 2 gold medals in Rome. And what was behind that was the coach Arthur Lydiard and his training philosophy and principles, which today are still very, very relevant. And what he developed was the long, slow running, the long distance.
Long, slow distance, yeah.
Yeah. And really, I mean, Snell against Roger Mullins from Belgium, who was the world record holder at that time, was Snell ran 100-mile weeks. This was unheard of for an 800-meter runner. And so when you think that Herb Elliott won the 1,500 meters in Rome,
yep.
Snell the 800 meters, Helberg the 5,000 meters, and Barry McGee won the bronze medal in the marathon. So the whole world turned to Down Under and go, what are they doing down there?
And it was all the long, slow distance.
Yes, and it was the distance running that prepared the runners aerobically. And then, of course, racing and aerobically would combine the two. And even science today, and, of course, Peter Snell, who is Professor Peter Snell, Dr.
Yes.
Sir Peter Snell, 40, 50 years of study of human performance. And if you ask Snell today what he knows today, how would you have done anything differently back in the 60s, Peter, knowing what you do today? And he said, very little.
Right.
That actually, Lydiard he was considered a little bit wacky.
Of course he was, yeah.
You don't need to run hundreds of miles to run a mile. But he said you've got to build the body slowly, like a pyramid. Build your base and work towards a peak. And the Olympic Games were, in those days, were the peak.
That was it. That was all there was.
Yeah.
So when you look, speaking of Olympic Games, 72, you end up with the, you take the bronze in the your first Olympic experience. What was your feeling knowing that as you're coming down the final straight that you're going to medal in your first Olympic Games?
Well, it was very, very overwhelming, Bob. I mean, here it was in the first heat, and two had to go through it, but history will show us that Ryan tripped and fell.
Yes, yes.
And I came second behind Kino. It was quite extraordinary. I mean, that was a huge thrill. Then we kind of, you know, had overnight, and then the next round, the semifinals were the next day. And then I went on to win my semifinal heat. And that was kind of overwhelming, I think.
Sure.
I think in those days we could ring New Zealand, but you had to book in 2 days ahead to make the phone call. And I knew that the goal is to make the final. And he said, and you call me after the first day and the second day. And so I booked those calls to my brother 2 or 3 days earlier. And, of course, when I came over to call and tell him, you know, how I felt, and he told me, you know, what we should be planning on doing, and he said, you know, how you ran brilliantly, and he said, and that's the way to run the semifinal, and let's get through that. And so I got through that, and, of course, I went over at the allotted time, 8 o'clock, I think, in the night, and I called him, and he said, all you've got to do now is do exactly what you did again today. Be there. Don't allow Kino to get away, because Kino had a very set way of running, and that is he would sit back for the first 400 to 500 meters and then come through and run the next 800 meters at like almost 1:50.
Wow.
And he said, and then the thing is whoever was left really didn't have much of a challenge in the last lap. But he said, that's where you will get stronger, because in 1971, Bob, I finished 10th in the world cross country. So I had this great range even in those days, all that Harrier running, cross-country
sure.
running. And so therefore, he said, you will start to be better in every heat. And of course, I must admit, running the final actually felt better than the first round. And I think I'd learned a few things and I'd got a bit of confidence, and I think that's what the key was. But I remember, as soon as the gap came, I closed it down. And with a lap to go, Kino was leading, and Vasila, the Finn,
yes.
he moved up, and they moved very quickly, and I was actually caught with a gap. And then into the turn, on the last lap, with about 150 meters to go, Mike Boyd, who had
sure.
a bronze medal in the 800 meters, passed me. And I think it fired me off. It got me a point where I realized that I actually have to go with him. And when I responded, I actually got a fright because I actually responded with so much speed, and I took off, and I was actually catching Kaino. I wasn't catching Vasila, but I was certainly catching Kaino. But and I think it's still written that of all the Olympic medalists, Rod Dixon, who won the bronze medal, probably was the happiest guy. It was just mind blowing, and I remember looking up into the stands and seeing all the New Zealand rowers who had won the gold medal for the men's eight, and they were all gesturing, it's beer time, you know.
And it was. It was beer time. Yeah. I love that. One of the events that we really hadn't chatted about much was the Commonwealth Games 1974, the 1500.
Yeah.
And you ended up running a time that would have been the second fastest in history. You ran 3:33.9, and that would have ended up being the second fastest time in history before the race.
Yes. Yep.
But in that race, Philbert Bailly goes 3:32.2, John Walker 3:32.5, Jip Joe 3:33.2, and you 3:33.9.
Very good.
That has to be one of the most amazing races of all time. To be, you know, afterwards you're going, gosh, I took fourth, that's a bummer. But you were in, you know, up until that time, the fastest 1500 ever.
Yes, well, it was. I'd beaten Walker over a mile about 6 weeks before the Commonwealth Games, and unfortunately, I just had a tweak of a sciatica problem, and I wasn't able to go for the opening, and I was getting treatment on a daily basis, but all the good work was there. We didn't panic at that stage because we know that we'd done the conditioning, and we've just got to get through this, and I was able to. Do some a couple of good time trials prior to going down to Christchurch, but certainly going into the race, and I thought I was in 3:35 condition.
Yeah.
And I really did think that it would take 3:34 to 3:35 to win it. So we really believed that I was in with a chance to get a medal.
Yeah.
To be in the top three for sure, and so as the race unfolded, of course, those who watched it, it was just extraordinary. This was history, absolutely the fastest 1500 meter race of all time. And really, when I finished, Bob, and I finished fourth, and you don't get anything for fourth.
No.
and I looked up and I saw the time, and I go, hold on a minute, I've just run the fourth fastest time in history. No, I've just
run. It would have been the second fastest in history.
It was the second fastest time in history, and I finished fourth in the race.
I love that.
I said, now that is not fair.
So, and what a lot of people don't realize is people watch the Steve Prefontaine movies. And I don't think there's anybody who raced pre more than you did in your career, starting with right after 72 Olympics, you took the bronze at 1500. Pre took the fourth.
Fourth,
yeah. In the five. And so they did a 2-miler in Crystal Palace, in London with the two of you guys there. And obviously that's a 2-miler. If I'm Rod Dixon, I'm going, well, I'm going to sit in here. This is a long way for me.
Yeah. I'm stepping up, and he's coming down. So
yeah.
It really was the 2-mile. In fact, Bob, the 2-mile was my best event, and there wasn't enough of them. But I think in 1973 or 74, I was the fastest 2-miler in the world.
Yeah,
and I think I had like 3 or 4 times in the top 5 or 6 times. I just couldn't get someone to help me. No one was running faster than I was at that distance. I ended up being 1/10 of a second off the world record in 1974. And that was disappointing because I really, as we saw with Walker in 75, he put his mind to it and he went out there and he set the whole race up. And I really should have got one of the meet directors to set the race up for me.
Sure.
There was a lot of controversy over rabbits in those days.
Yes.
And they said, if it was clear that there was an intention by a runner to lead out and set the pace and then pull out of the race, you will not be, you'll be disqualified. You won't be able to claim a record. So we had to be quite careful on that. And, of course, leading the challenge was, of course, is the British Board, the British Amateur Athletic Board, who, you know, this amateurism and the attitudes. And yet, you know, 1954, Roger Bannister had three pace limits,
right?
Didn't he?
Yes.
And here was the British Board telling us we weren't allowed to have pace.
So when you raced against Pree, because Pree was a very mercurial guy, and, you know, one of those guys, I think, when I watched some of the documentaries, they talked about that he felt for the 5,000 that, hey, I'm gonna run the last mile in 4 minutes, but he didn't race the Europeans that much.
Right.
So he went over there thinking, hey, I'm the only one who can do this, and all the Euro, everybody knew that they could do it too.
Yes.
So I think he was sort of surprised when he made his move and didn't win.
That's right. After we ran in London together, I mean, I set the British Commonwealth New Zealand records.
Yep.
And he set an American record. But he came over to me and he pointed his finger at me and he said, "You sit on me again and I'll hit you." And I'm looking at the guy going, "What? You want to get into a scrap? I'm a scrapper from way back."
Exactly. And so you basically sat on him and outkicked him.
Yes.
Which, of course, you should do. That's racing.
That's exactly. Tactical.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until we joined up in 1973 when we started to race a bit more at each other. More often in Europe and Scandinavia, that we became. I mean, I remember I beat him in a 2 mile again in Stockholm, and he led for most of the race. And then Egypto, Puttemans, myself went past him in the last 300 yards.
Yeah,
and I think I won it in 8:14.5 or something like that. And he once again he was very angry that no one would share the race. And I said to him, I said, it's not about how fast you run, it's how many times you've got to be the win.
Right.
You know, winning, you're only as good as your last race in this country, in Europe.
In this world, yeah.
So you've got to be a winner to be invited to the next race. Because you ran a fast time and you didn't win, that doesn't mean anything to these people.
No. Nah.
And so Walker and I went off down to Italy to race a couple of races, and we came, and we didn't know this, but Pree came down to Milan. We came into the hotel to check in, and there was Ralph Mann, the great 400-meter hurdler.
Yep.
And Pree in the lobby, and Pree just sort of was like, "Oh my gosh, what the hell is he? What are these guys doing here?
Yeah.
Coming to spoil my party?"
Right.
We didn't even acknowledge him, and Ralph Mann came over to us and he said, "Look, you know, I can see what's going on, the dynamics between you Kiwis and Pree." And he said, "You know, you may not like each other, but actually, you actually are all the same peas in the pot."
Right.
And he said, "Why don't you join us for dinner tonight?" And which we did.
Yep.
And of course, the first thing is we said, "Well, let's get a few beers." And we got a few more.
So we're talking sitting having dinner, and it's Ralph Mann, but it's Steve Prefontaine, John Walker, and Rod Dixon.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. My God.
That's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool.
I think after about the fifth or sixth beer, we said, "Look, whatever we do tonight, and how much ever we drink, we're going out at 7 a.m. in the morning, and we're doing 15 milers." And we all agreed. And it was amazing how quickly the drinking stopped.
And so when you guys went out, it was just the three of you.
The three of us.
Running through Milan.
Running all around the farmlands and we were just north out of Milan.
Yeah. But
it was still fabulous when we went into this great big park. And you know, and I didn't carry a watch, and Walker didn't carry a watch, and Pree wasn't wearing a watch. But we knew what we were, you know, we knew we couldn't do the talk test. We weren't long conversations because we were running at almost race pace.
And you guys were sort of playing a little game.
Yep. So,
you know, you would go off the front,
yep,
and Pree would chase you down. And then then you guys would recover, and then Walker would go off the front. How many times did you do that before Pree realized what the hell was going on?
He took everyone. He took every challenge. He took every... I must admit, Bob, I you know, I said, "How many more is he going to do of these?" And he's a tough little nut.
Yeah.
And he took all of them. And we came back and, you know, we the high fives and everything else, a couple of beers.
Yep.
And then the next day we just had, we realized that we've got to have an easy day, you guys. You know, I can feel this. I can feel what we did yesterday. We've got to race in two more days. But, you know, we took the next day. We just all agreed we'd just go a light run in the morning, a light run in the afternoon, because we wanted to do speed work the next day.
Right.
And then the race, I think, was 3 days later. And we went down to the track, and I think I did some 600s. Walker was doing some 400s. And Pree said he's going to run 2 by 1 mile. And there were just the four of us.
Yeah.
Because Ralph Mann came down. He was doing some training. And Pree went out and ran 4:02 for his first mile. He took 10 minutes. And he went out and ran 3:59.3. And
wow.
I looked at Walker and I said, ooh, we're in trouble. This guy is good.
Yeah.
And that was Pree. I think in Milan at the race, which was about 3 or 4 days later, I had to revalue what I said. If he's going to get in the front, he's going to run me off my legs. So he came up to me and he said, do you want to share the pace? And I said, no, because I knew I had to get him upset. I knew I had to
get
dislodge
into his head a little
him
bit.
From this way, because he just showing me 2 days earlier what he could do. And he said, Dixon's got to be worried. Now I'm going to ask him to share the pace, which he's not going to like doing. And I said, I'm not going to do it. So he ran. As much as he was running it to show me, in the second lap, I came up to his shoulder and eased past him. And then I ran, you know, two laps as hard as I could, at that knowing what I had to do. And then, of course, then he came in, took another lap, and then we were both, and we'd run away from the rest of the field, and some very, very good runners. And we were coming up to the bell lap, and I'm leading, and I'm thinking, I'm going to run as hard as I can as a 1,500-meter runner. I'm going to try and run as fast as I can for this. Just around the turn, 300 meters, he goes past me, and he opens up a good 5-6-meter gap. And I tell you, I thought I was running very, very fast, and he was running away from me. And we went down the back straight, and just into the turn, I noticed he just had a little bit of a falter. And that was enough to give me, you know, to throw myself now into my mile speed, which was, you know, I'd run 3:51, and Pree had run 3:55, I think. So there was 4 seconds there. So I came up to his shoulder, down the home straight, and we ran stride for stride. And in the last 15 to 20 meters, I edged ahead one body length. Once again, American record, New Zealand record, Commonwealth record. And I think at that stage, when we, you know, embraced, there was respect.
Exactly.
And from that point, I can tell you, Bob, for the rest of 73, all of 74, we came over here for indoors in March of 75. We were talking about going to Boulder, Colorado to set up training for 76 for the Olympic Games. We, the three, Prefontaine, Dixon, and Walker, were inseparable. We were great mates. He was going to come to New Zealand that summer.
Wow.
And train. And tragically, in May of 75, we lost him.
Ugh. God. So when you go to, you're going to the 76 Olympics in Montreal, and you took a bronze 4 years earlier, and also in that, in 72, Lassie Viren had, you know, doubled in the, you know, So now you're, you know, you got Lassie Viren, four-time Olympic champion, Dick Quacks, Klaus, Peter Hildebrand. And it comes down to that, what, the last couple yards, right? Hildebrand, he dove for the bronze?
Yeah, he did. I'll just go back. In 74, it was, you know, especially with the Commonwealth Games behind us, I recognized that, you know, suddenly with John Walker and Filbert Bay, we had a whole new dimension of 1500 meter running.
Right.
And, you know, Jip Joe had decided he was going to retire, so he wasn't in the picture. But I also, too, recognized there was a few other guys very, very capable of running that time. And so I think it's, you know, what do? You say, I think it's time for me to move to 5,000.
Exactly.
And so in 74, running in Europe, it made it very clear to me that 5,000 meters was going to be my focus for the Olympic Games in 76. So when I went in 75, I ran specific 5,000 meter time races against the best in the world, and I beat them all, and I ended up getting number one ranking in the world for 5,000 meters.
Right.
So there was a lot of confidence going into 76. So when we came, now I must admit, Bob, I really valued the African influence in running because of Bayi with the front running, and Jip Joe and Kino, there was some very good runners from John Nano, who won to Washington State. There were some very good African runners, and I valued their contribution. And of course, the boycott of the African nations eliminated all the Africans out of the Olympics in 76.
Oh, that's right.
And so there was a change now in the way things are. And the races definitely went almost back to the typical European, which was slow.
Sit and kick. Yeah, where the Africans were unpredictable.
Yes.
They'd taken flyers off the front, working for each other, all that type of stuff.
Yeah. And also, too, in the heat of that 5,000 meters, my heat, I had to run nearly 44 seconds faster than Varin did when he qualified. Brendan Foster was first, I was second, and everybody else, fifth, sixth, and seventh, were right behind us. We set an Olympic record in our heat.
Oh, my God.
So, and I remember Dick Berkeley, the great indoor runner and world record for the mile indoors and 5,000-meter runner, and he was in our heat. And when we finished, I saw him in the tunnel after, and I go, well, that wasn't a good... And I said, how did you do? And he said, I didn't qualify. And I said, why? And he said, you were running so fast, I thought you'd come back.
And so I said,
well,
let it
Dick,
go, yeah.
That's a big mistake. We're not going to come back.
Nobody's coming back in the Olympics.
I must admit, I looked around, and I would have rather had a slower race.
Of course.
But I looked around, there were six guys there, and I said, well, you know, you've got to be here to make the next round. So you don't try and run easy. You better start running hard. Because if you try to run easy in a hard race, it's going to take more out of you. So I went into the final just a little bit, I suppose, a little bit anxious because we'd had to run so fast.
Sure.
And then, of course, I must admit, 600 meters to go, I'm looking around and I'm thinking, no one can beat me.
Yeah.
You know, no one can beat me over a mile. I'm the fastest 1,500 meter. A 1,000-meter runner. In fact, I'm faster than anybody here over 800 meters.
Sure.
So with 300 meters to go, where I was, my brother, Coach John, he said, you've got to be in control with 300 meters, and no one gets past you. You just hold them. But you know who was at that position at 300 meters to go?
Varin, yeah.
And he held us all off, doing exactly what I was meant to. And, of course, we got into the turn, and next thing is Quack's going past me. Hildebrand came up on the inside of me. Varin was out the front, and I'm counting fourth again.
Yes.
The horror from 74.
Yes.
Is coming back. And I launched myself around the turn in lane three, almost into lane four, up the home straight, and I just ran out of gas.
And then Hildebrand dove across, and it was like 0.74 of a second out of the bronze.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. How disappointing was that for you?
It was devastating, Bob.
Yeah.
I was in disbelief, of course. I think I walked into the tunnel, and all the media wanted to talk to me. I just went and got my bag, took my shoes off, and ran out the stadium and ran over to the village.
Yeah.
I ran all the way up to my room, up the stairs, And I got on the bed, and Bob, I burst into tears.
Sure.
I was devastated. I had trained so well and so hard, and yet I had come up short. And I didn't know what to do. And, you know, at that point, I think my brother's voice was inside me, and he said, "You get up and you continue to compete because you believe in yourself. Now get back over to that stadium and watch the rest of the events. Go over there and go out and believe in yourself that you've got self-worth, that you've got the value, and go out and compete because you know you have every right to believe in yourself and believe that you can be a champion." And you know, I did. I went over there, and then I went on to Europe. I won the Van Damme meet.
Yep.
Beat all the Olympic medals. I went on and won the British 1500 meters, beating Sebastian Coe.
Yes.
Beating Frank Clement, who finished fourth in the Olympic final. Coughlin finished fourth.
Yeah.
Frank was fifth. I beat Heinz Wilman, who got the bronze medal. I beat everybody in Europe that year, even from 1500 to 5000. I won everything. But it was still. That's what I was meant to do at the Olympics, but I didn't.
Yeah, but 4 years earlier you did. You got the bronze.
Yeah.
But that's always so tough. What's so tough about the Olympics, when that was the only way to measure yourself in running,
yes,
is you had 4 years. So yeah, someone like Alassi Virran could do nothing in between, and then all of a sudden he's taking 5 and 10 in 72 and 76.
76.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't really matter what they did in between.
Right.
It's all about...
I raced Virran nearly 8 times, and I beat him 7.
Yeah, the one time he got you was in the finals of the 5000.
The Olympic final.
The one sort of that matters.
I would have traded all those others.
Of course. So talk a little bit about the relationship with John Walker. I mean, here you've got two great New Zealand athletes, and you guys were traveling together, right? I'm assuming you fly into a place, you'd rent a car together, you'd share a room.
Well, no, we didn't rent a car, Bob. We didn't have enough money for
it. Oh, you didn't have a car? Yeah, that's right. You guys weren't making much money, right?
I'd say to John, well, you know, you better run the 800 meters and I'm running the 1500 meters because we've got to get 2 vouchers here.
Oh, that's right, because otherwise you're making nothing.
Yeah, and there's no point in me finishing second to him. That doesn't pay for the next week ahead or... In 73, of course, we bussed, we trained. When we were successful at one of the big meets, we got an air ticket to the next one.
Right.
But when in your downtime, which we knew we had to take because we just couldn't be racing twice a week every week, and so we would pick smaller races up north of Sweden or
sure,
in Finland, and we would say to the race director, you know, just give us 10 days accommodation at a training facility so that we can do our training, we can have 3 meals a day, we have a nice dry bed and cool, and that's what we would do. We would race for accommodation meals and then come back to the big meets in Oslo or Stockholm or Helsinki or Dusseldorf or Rieti to get some dollars.
So could you make a living at that point, or did you have to have another job?
Oh, no, we had a job in New Zealand. You had to keep your day job.
What'd you do?
Well, what we did, I was working for an insurance company, but they wouldn't give me the time off. So I got a job at a local hospital. It's actually a mental institution. Yeah, Clockwork Cookies Nest, mate. I study horticulture. And so I'd go to school during the week and do horticulture, and that allowed me time for training because this hospital was in against the mountains. It was unbelievable. It was like Richmond Park in England. You
yeah.
know, it was just beautiful park, like I said. And I'd go off, and my boss was actually European, so he knew the value of training. And he would say to me in the morning, he said, "Have you trained today?" And I said, "Oh, no, I'll do that." He said, you put that down now and you go out and train. We've got to have you in the best shape of your life." So that was a great opportunity to, you know, kind of get a paycheck And to be able to train and have great conditions, I was outside all the time. And then they would give me 3 months off to go off to Europe and race. And I remember when I said to Walker in 73, I said, why don't you come to Europe with Quacks and myself? And he said, oh, have you got a ticket? And I said, no. I said, have you got a car? And he said, yes. And I said, well, sell it. And he said, but I spent all my life. I said, John, sell it.
Right.
How else are you going to get an air ticket? And I said, and I'll tell you what, John, that's going to make you hungry. If you do well in Europe, you'll be able to come home and buy that car back again. If you do really well, you might be able to get a better car. And so that's what we did in the first year, 73. We sold our car to fund our trip. And there's something about knowing that you've got limited dollars in your pocket.
Right.
And you better run fast and get a paycheck.
Well, and the other thing, I remember talking to Australian guys in terms of triathlon. It's not like when you leave home in New Zealand or Australia, you go to Europe or you go to the States, it's not like you're flying back and forth. You're there. You're going
there.
To Europe, and you're there for 6 months.
Yep.
And so as a young person, you're basically, you better figure out the languages and how to eat and train and places to stay. Was there any funding from from New Zealand?
No
sports funding at all?
No. They in fact, what we had to do is that when I was in Europe, and of course I went and stayed in Saariavi in Finland in 73, and I learned, well, in fact, in 72 I met Vasila, who is the Olympic champion.
Yeah.
And he started to tell me what I would need to be thinking about if I'm coming back to Europe and Scandinavia next year. And so this was, you know, you're going to have to get your funding right, you're going to have to figure out what meets can pay you air tickets. Because, you know, if you're going to go to Czechoslovakia or Poland or anything like that, they're not going to give you Western currency. So you've got to get air tickets out of those guys. And so we would get air tickets for everywhere we needed to go out of the Eastern European countries. And then you would, Italy and that would pay you good money, you know, pay
you sure.
cash. The only thing is the lira wasn't worth much out of Italy. So you'd be a millionaire, and then when you cashed it in England, you suddenly realize you got $550.
But
it was, you know, that's how we lived.
Of course.
And trained. And
made you tough.
Yeah, it was. It was a wonderful experience. And, of course, John, we became great, great friends. We trained. There was no competitiveness about it. We were just great mates. We were great friends. He was terrible about doing his laundry. I mean, I had to end up doing his for him too. But he'd you know, leave all his clothes under the sink, and he'd say, oh, when are we going to Adidas next? And I said, 3 days. He said, oh, I don't need to do any washing.
He'd just pick up new clothes.
Yeah.
So with I remember you telling me that when you guys were racing, that whoever won had to buy the beer and fill up the bathtub? I love that.
Yeah, and that was we got pre a couple of times on that before we realized what we were doing.
So pre, you win, and so you have to buy the beer.
Yeah, because, you know, some of the races only paid, you know, like $150 or $200, and that would almost take the whole $200 to fill the bathtub.
I love
well, actually,
that.
Not right, but it certainly took a good chunk of it. And I said to John, I said, you know, we don't have another race for 10 days after this.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, that bathtub, if you win, is going to cost you $60. And I said, so he said, well, I'm not winning tonight. And I said, well, if you're not, I'm not. And I said, yeah, let's make sure that Pre wins tonight.
That is great.
It was pleasant. But he cottoned on to that. And we, you know, it was all this little fun and games that we had, and there was a relaxed attitude, a great camaraderie, great friendship, great love for one another. We love what we're doing. You know, if you get paid for it, there's always a bonus, but that was not why we were there.
You were there trying. It was mainly you were there because you loved it, and you eventually you're going to go back to the Olympics.
Yes.
So, of all the runners, obviously John Walker was amazing talent. Steve Prefontaine. But you also had exposure to Henry Rono.
Yes.
What type of talent was he?
Oh, unbelievable! Just that was raw talent. That was just But, you know, what we did know, Bob, is that Africa had that much talent.
Right.
A lot of these athletes were just not getting the chance to come away because, you know, you had to first of all, the Africans had to get a visa, and that was very hard because they had no means of proving this financial support.
Sure.
No race director was prepared to give them an air ticket, and then, you know, if they didn't perform or something, you know, that was... So it was very difficult for them to come. But what a lot of the Africans... There was a number of Africans who were in school here, college here.
Yep.
And they would come away. And I remember John Nano, he would ask for $763 a race. And I go, John, I can understand 700 or 750 or 800, but what's the 763? And he said, that buys me one cow.
So basically, one cow is his appearance fee.
Yeah. And so if he ran six races, he would have six cows. And do you know, and with all due respect, this is what it was in those days. John told me, he said, one cow can get you two wives.
Oh, you could trade a cow for a couple wives.
You can. That is the dowry that you give to her family, a cow, and he allows you to have his daughter for a wife.
Nice.
And they would have three or four wives.
So they better get a bunch of cows.
Yes. It really was, and I looked at it and I thought, wow, gosh, you know. And I remember I wrote a letter to my father and I said, you know, we've got 16,000 sheep. Did you have to do a lot of running to get those?
That is funny.
It was all good stuff. Lovely stuff.
Did you run against Henry?
Yes, a lot of races. I came across Henry in 77. He came to New Zealand. And I beat him a couple of times. And, of course, you could see the talent that he
sure.
was. And then he, of course, in 70, I'm just trying to think, when he set the four world records that year, 10,000, 5,000, the steeplechase.
Yes.
And just trying to think, 3,000.
3,000, yes.
Yeah. And then he came to New Zealand, and, of course, for me to beat him, as the four-time world record holder.
Yes.
And that was huge in New Zealand. And, of course, it was great for our sport. It inspired runners. And I even Nick Willis, our silver medalist from Athens, and recent bronze medalist at the Commonwealth Games, he said, you know, that's what inspired him, all those racing by Walker and Dixon and the track series and how we used to bring all the Europeans out to New Zealand train and race.
Right.
And that really, New Zealand were enjoying a very, very high level of awareness.
So with Henry, he also had a little bit of a drinking issue.
Yes.
Just a little bit. And I think he came over to New Zealand, your race promoter brought him over, and race promoter comes walking in the lobby, and there's his talented athlete face down in the lobby, like drunk. Right, and then I think there was a meet coming up in a couple of days.
Yes.
And he gave him a little bit of an ultimatum that, Henry, I'm going to take you to the track, and you're going to have to run, what, do you have to run some quarters?
He had to prove that he wasn't just here on a drinking holiday.
Yeah, you're right.
By running 10 quarters.
10 quarters.
10 quarters. And he said, I expect you to run them around 60 seconds, and I'm going to give you 30 seconds recovery. And
you guys all wanted to go to the track and watch that.
I mean, it was like a busload of us going down. And we went down there, and we were in the stands. And, you know, and Henry did his warm-up, and then he came up, and he did the first one. And he, you know, he came through, and he had enough time to jog around and come back and go into the next one. And
under 60.
He just reeled them off.
Yeah.
I would say all those 10 were done between 59.5 and 61.
Wow.
The whole 10 with 30 seconds recovery. And then, this is it, Bob, 4 days later in Melbourne, in the 10,000 meters against the best, some of the best, you know, Di Castella and all these guys in the 10,000 meters. And they were coming, the leaders almost came to lap Henry. And we were watching Henry drifting off, and I said, whoa, those quarters really cooked him.
Yeah.
And he's going to be going home tomorrow. And Henry looked over his shoulder and saw them coming, and he took off. Within four laps, he was on the tail of those leaders. He went on to run 28.01 for 10,000 meters, which was then the world leader. And Henry was on his way for the rest of his travels.
He would basically made up a quarter mile on Di Castella and the best guys in the world.
Yeah.
After being flat on the floor of the hotel 5 days earlier.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, when we went to Australia, this was just before that race, we were in Australia, and no one could find Henry. And what he'd done is he'd gone down to a local bar, hooked up with a whole lot of Aborigines, and they took him on walkabout. They went and he disappeared for like 2.5 or 3 days. And he came back, and that was when he came back, and they kind of brought him in and dropped him in the lobby floor and ran away. and that was when Andy Norman, who is the British promoter, he was the one who said, this is not going to happen on my watch, and sat him up in the chair, and Henry was slumped over. And then over the next 4 days, this is what happened. It was extraordinary.
I love that. So Rodney, you go from the 1,500 meters to the 5,000. And I love your, you know, when you look at your range from 829 in the steeple to 333.9 in the 1,500 and, 351 for the mile and half marathon, 102.12. Nobody has range like that anymore. When you were ranked number one in the world at 5,000 meters, when you decided to step up to the marathon, I mean, did you look back and go, hey, I was a 1,500-meter runner not that long ago. What the heck am I doing?
Well, certainly, you know, nobody, and, you know, we're talking nearly 30-odd years ago.
Yeah.
So nobody was doing that.
No.
And I know our media, because of Walker, you know, the Olympic champion and world record holder, and they said, you know, that, you know, Dixon could have had all that, but he chose to be, like...
More versatile.
Yeah.
Right. He didn't focus. He
jack of all trades, master of none.
Well, you were a master of a lot.
Yeah, but you know they said, I think it goes back to my school day where I was easily distracted.
Sure.
I enjoyed the challenge of different things. And you know, I mean, here I was, world cross country, 2-time world cross country medal, steeplechase, indoor running. I almost set the world record for the mile indoor. And I was a 6'2" guy. I was not an Eamon Coughlin.
Exactly.
I struggled, and yet I had so much talent over a number of events. And but I think, you know, when I switched to the roads because of the boycott at the Olympics in 1980, and I think that's when I started to feel that this was my pathway. This is what I'm really good at.
Well, and also I think what fit you so well is road racing is really more about entertaining. And you are that type of guy. You're a personality. You know, there's more stuff going on in a road race, and the fans are right there. It's different than the track is like symphony, and road is like rock and roll.
That's perfect, Bob. You really did, and I really drew into this. I think, you know, after the boycott came on, we were in Philadelphia, and the team was going on to Europe, and I said to the coach, I said, you know, I'm not going to go to Europe. I mean, I've trained for Europe, but I said, you know, I'm going to go there, race, and then I have to sit in the stands and watch the Olympics.
Yeah.
I said, there's a road race this weekend, and Bill Rogers is coming to run it. I said, I'm going to go and run that, because I met Bill in 1978, and I said, you know, he'll remember me. And sure enough, I go down to Philadelphia to run the race, and I go over to see Bill, but I have to wait. You know, there's about 50 people around Bill.
Yeah.
And I go through and I go, Bill, how, you know, Rod Dixon, oh, Rod. Because when he was in Europe in 78, it was the other way around. He had to wait to meet me.
Of course.
And I remember I remember a great 10,000 meter race in Stockholm at the Olympic Stadium, and I'm looking down through the field, and I say, look, you guys, there's Bill Rogers and Tohashi Seiko.
Yes.
Probably the two greatest marathon runners of our time. And here they are in this 10,000 meters. Why are they here? Because they know they're only going to get faster at the marathon by running these sort of races and coming over to Europe and running them.
Exactly.
And here they were. And the real race was between those two. And they're at the back of the field, but they're still running 28 minutes.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I remember Bill finished, and of course he finished like third last, and Seiko was fourth last. You know, it was like amazing. And Bill came over, and nobody talked to him, and I went down, and I said, Rod Dixon, and, you know, what? I just loved your race. And Bill looked at me almost like, really?
Yeah, like, you like me finishing next to last, yeah.
And I said to him, why don't you come back? Why don't we go to the cafe there and have pizza and a beer later on? He came over, and of course all the athletes were there, and Bill was there, and he was such a delightful person. And then, of course, when I 1980, and I saw him, and he was just delightful, just like he was then.
Yeah.
And we ran the race, and a guy called Gary Finale actually won the race. Bill was second, I was third, and of course, I just wore my training shoes. I didn't have any special racing shoes. And I knew at that moment I could be good at this. And so I started to say, right, well, obviously I need a shoe similar to what I use on the track, so I'll use the spike last and the spike upper and just put a sole on it.
Sure. So what, did you build your own shoes?
Yep. Built my own shoes.
Really?
Yep.
Had you always done that?
I'd always done that. I'd always had special made shoes.
That you made yourself?
Yeah. Well, actually, with the help of, you know, the technician.
I gotcha.
I mean...
But you would design them?
Yeah. I'd design them, and this is what I want. And it was funny because when I first, in the first year, John Walker was under contract to Brooks.
Yep.
And I said to John, I said, can you give me a couple of those shoes? Give me a couple of pair of those, because Adidas didn't want me racing road races. They wanted me back in Europe.
They wanted you on the track.
And so they weren't going to support me, so I knew that I didn't have a shoe company. And so I thought, right, okay, well, what I'll do is go, I've got to establish myself here on the roads, and I should be able to, you know, hook up with, you know, Saucony or Adidas or not so much Adidas, Nike or somebody.
Sure.
And they gave me the shoes, and I looked at them, so what I did is I just took the sock liner out and run right on the bare board, right on the heart of the...
Yeah.
And, you know, but what happens when you take the sock liner out, you go further into the shoe, which means it comes up around your ankle more and digs in, and then the heel tab comes up and really hurts your tendon.
Sure.
So I had to get a pair of scissors and cut the back tab and then put some slices around the what we call the throat of the shoe.
Yep.
So that it wasn't, you know, so that it opened it up a little bit more.
I love that.
And then the next race I won, and then Brooks, the guy from Brooks was there, and he said, "Oh, what have you done to our shoes?" And I said, I've customized them. And they said, "Why don't you come down? We would like to help you get some shoes." So we went down, and I remember, Bob, they said, what will it take to get you into our shoes? And I go, just give me cash, because I got to pay my rent.
Sure.
Pay da, da, da. And they asked me how much, and they, oh, no, we can't pay you that. And I said, well, what? They said, what will put you on, Dixon? Okay, well, I'm going to tell you. I wanted $25,000.
Yes.
They said, no, we're not going to give you $25,000. But what we will do is we'll give you a list of races that if you win, you'll get a bonus. So they gave me A, B, C, and D grade races.
With different money associated.
Yeah. Yeah. And I looked at the A, and obviously I couldn't run all those A races every time. I had to have a few Bs in there.
Sure.
And then if I'm hungry enough, maybe I'll run two Ds in a weekend. I'll run Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah.
And I'll win those two, which will give me almost as much as a B race. So Well, I went, Bob, I wanted $25,000. They ended up paying me $37,000 at the end of the year.